Greetings. You're with the Manic Gardener, where each week we explore some aspect of organic or sustainable gardening. This week's gardening tip comes from Jason Kim, whom I'm interviewing, since I end by asking him for his advice to home gardeners. I want to start with a saying and a fairy tale. The saying first. We are all familiar with this one. You're the apple of my eye. You'd never say, you're the potato of my eye. However, lovingly, unless you wanted to be punched in the eye. And this gives some indication of the low status of the potato in our imagination and in our imaginative and literary lives. Nevertheless, we're going to return this week to the seed potato farm of Jason and Yvonne Kim. Last week we heard part one, in which Yvonne showed us around the farm and explained the organic potato farming that she and Jason are engaged in. This week we'll spend time with Jason in the field, in a windrower part of the time, hearing how he has worked to make his farm more sustainable and how his bit of a dancing accident with Yvonne. Slight contrast there with her description of that accident last week, but then I explicitly said to Jason, I won't ask. My bad. At any rate, we'll hear how that accident led to their mutual conversion, not just to organic farming, but to a fuller sense of stewardship for the earth and everything that grows within it and that lives upon it. Now, I know that potatoes are not very exciting as vegetables go. Lettuce is pretty, carrots are colorful, and of course, everybody loves tomatoes. But I'm beginning to think that potatoes get sort of a raw deal. And to illustrate this, it's time for a fairy tale. This is something that I remember reading many years ago. And it's sort of a version of the King Lear tale, in which a king asks two or three daughters, depending on the version, how much they love him. And the first couple of daughters fall over themselves to say that they love him more than any riches, more than life itself, more than their own blood, their own children, etc., etc. Impossible promises. Well, the youngest one goes out on a limb and says something very plain and ordinary. In Lear, she says, I love you according to my bond, no more, no less. In the fairy tale, she says, I love you as I love the salt on my meat. And just as Cordelia is thrown out in King Lear, so this youngest daughter is tossed out by her furious father. And eventually she marries a prince and she gives a dinner to which she invites her father. Somehow she goes unrecognized by him. I'm not sure how she manages that. But she serves a beautiful meal. And all the guests sit down full of hunger and delight and start to eat. And then slowly stop eating because the food is not very interesting. There is no salt. So it is with potatoes. They're not romantic. They're not dramatic. But would you want to live without them? Under the influence of that story, you may be willing to concede, fine, potatoes are great. Three cheers for potatoes. But growing them? How hard can that be? And indeed, in the home garden, they're quite easy. I mean, you can blow it. You can blow almost anything. But generally speaking, you put either whole potatoes or pieces of potatoes in the ground and you will get potatoes to eat afterwards. But what I found was that growing them on a large scale at a farm is an entirely different matter. I went out to that farm knowing that I knew nothing. But when I returned, it was as though I had been given a map of my ignorance, which was a landscape covering a much vaster area than I had ever realized. Certainly, I would never have put down potato farming as an extraordinarily intellectually demanding activity. But oh my gosh, listen to this guy. He's talking at one moment about research done 60 years ago in France. 5 minutes later, he's talking about very current research about acrylamides. And then again, he's talking about ongoing research in which people are comparing the nutrient content of native potatoes from South America to those grown on large-scale farms like his own in the United States. The range, the breadth of what this guy has to know is extraordinary. Now, part of the appeal in Jason's case, of course, is that paired with all that knowledge is someone who goes out and tests the soil moisture in his fields by sticking his hands in the dirt. But there's something else, which is that Jason has been using all that knowledge, all that biology, chemistry, and soil science to try to make his farm more sustainable, to improve the soil health and the health of the plants so that he can reduce the use of pesticides and of synthetic fertilizer. So just how much can a conventional farmer do to adopt sustainable practices? Quite a lot, as it turns out. If you heard last week's show, No Small Potatoes, you already know that this is a multi-generational effort involving Jason, his brother, his brother-in-law, his father, and his uncle. Yvonne took me to see the original farmhouse, a pretty yellow house, big windows, set amongst large trees, and surrounded by a whole cluster of red barns, sheds, and other buildings, all of which are still in use.
The house right there is the house that great-grandpa Henry lived in.
And he's the guy who bought this land.
He bought the farm. Grandpa Wilbur, Jason's grandfather, was born and raised in that house. Jason's dad was born and raised in that house. His dad only lived out of that house for, I think, 6 months or half a year.
In his whole life.
Well, he lived out of there from when he first got married until they had Jason. And I think Jason was only... They moved in the summertime. So Jason was 6 months old when they moved to that house.
Uh-huh.
And then Jason was raised there, and now Jason's younger brother, Mark, is actually going to take over the house.
That's great.
We broke the tradition of the eldest taking the house. But
I see. Once out at the harvesting site, I found myself looking at a large, deeply furrowed field, which looked pretty bare at this time of year, harvest time, because the potatoes are killed off, or at least the foliage is killed off, several weeks before the potatoes are to be harvested. But it was far from a barren site. This was nothing like agricultural land in the Midwest, where the fields go on for miles and miles, and there is almost nothing to interrupt that view or provide any distraction or relief. Instead, here, the fields are much smaller. There are trees at their edges. There's another field just beyond, which is green. And of course, since this is western Montana, there are always mountains in the background. In potato fields, the potatoes are planted not in the furrows, but in the hills between them, leaving the furrows free for the tires of trucks and tractors. In this particular field, there were plenty of pieces of large machinery. Windrowers, which dig up several rows of potatoes at once and dump them into one long line down one furrow. Harvesters, which pick them up and move them by conveyor belt up a chute and then dump them into a truck that goes alongside of them through the field. And then those trucks themselves. Yes, plenty of pieces of machinery in this field, but none of them were moving. They didn't move, in fact, for about 45 minutes. And yet, when everybody finally made it to the end of the field and piled out for lunch, I don't think I heard any expressions of annoyance. Instead, it was, and I know this sounds really corny, but it was like a Norman Rockwell painting come to life without the exaggeration and corniness. There were fathers, mothers, aunts, uncles, children, grandmothers, grandfathers, all milling around, greeting each other, and getting ready for lunch.
How are
Hi,
you?
you're
I'm
Jason,
Jason.
This is
right?
Jason.
Yeah.
Nice
Good
to
to
meet
meet
you.
you.
Yeah,
to
warn you, this is on. It's always on. I'm going to blackmail all of
Catching
you.
Everything we say.
That's right.
Let's see what we
have. How are you doing? How are you doing?
Daddy!
Well, are you going to be back before lunch is done? Then I'll just
Can you not
wait for
use
you.
it?
Hi,
Thank
Daddy.
you. I'll just take Hi, Addie.
Bye.
How are you today?
Bye, Daddy.
Bye-bye. Are you helping Grandma?
Yeah.
Jason had to run an errand, so I hopped into a truck beside him and asked him what had been holding up operations.
Oh, a disc from the landowner's. His disc broke in half. It's one of those great big pieces of iron came up over our chain here, and then it
Now, whose disc
wedges.
Broke? One of the harvesters
No,
here?
It's one of the previous landowners, just a piece of their equipment that stayed out in the field, and
Oh
it
my
ran
gosh.
Into the back of that machine and got wedged in the belts, and they get really, it's rubber belts.
And you don't
metal.
Want it ripped up.
And so there's slip clutches so that if you get something that wedges in those belts, the drive will slip so you don't tear the belt.
I see.
So we had to release all the belts, and then it's all full of dirt and potatoes, so you gotta undo all that stuff. And it takes a while, then you gotta try to bend it straight without taking it out, without torches and all the stuff that we normally get to work with. So.
The disc itself?
No, the disc I got out pretty quickly.
It's well, what are you trying to straighten then?
All the bars that go, you know, that carry the potatoes.
If they have been bent?
If they get, yeah, they were bent.
Wow.
And when they get bent and you drop all of, you know, your potatoes all, you lose potatoes every time it goes around.
So. Not good.
Not good. So whenever you harvest a field the first, I don't know, probably even 5 or 6 times, we get old horseshoes and old tools like, you know, like they used.
Archaeology.
Yeah. I mean, you get a lot of stuff.
So you, I know how you got into the potato business because your family's been in it forever.
Yep.
Generations.
Generations. Yep. Well, I mean, you can probably go back further than that, I think, in agriculture. But in this land here on the farm, the home farm, my great-grandpa bought that just right sort of during the Depression years.
Now, did you always intend to go into this family business? Did you ever consider doing something else?
Yeah, I pursued, well, I thought about medicine and...
That's different.
And flying, I wanted to commercial or Air
That's
Force
also different.
Pilot. So I got my pilot's license when I was 17, and I did an EMT while I was going to college for agriculture. So I had got to experience aviation and medicine to a certain degree. And
I crossed them off the list?
Yeah, I mean, I still practiced emergency medicine until 2 years ago here.
Really?
I kind of retired from the fire department. I did it in ambulance when I was going to school. And one of the improvements, just maybe out of interest to you, but just above the hill where those blue silos are up there, that's where the water for this farm comes from. And what they used to do is blow it down a little canal.
Wait, that, how does it come from there?
Well, the canal that feeds this farm, that this all the land in this valley is deeded to canals. So this, the water right that's deeded to this farm comes out of the Kewin Ditch, which runs, there's actually two ditches on that hill, and the lower you can see kind of cuts in the ground. One's mm-hmm. way at the very top, and one's just below that.
And where is it, the water in the ditch come from?
That's from the Gallatin River.
Okay.
And so what they used to do is kind of blow that off the head gate, and it ran down. And this is a native creek that flows here. This is the Yellow mm-hmm. Dog Creek, and the Yellow Dog drainage drains
the big, Yellow Dot Creek?
Yellow Dog.
Dog.
And it drains a pretty big chunk of this valley. So when we bought this, it cost a lot of money to run the electrical pumps and that kind of stuff. So right. what we did is we buried a pipe all the way from the top of that hill.
Right.
And there's over a mile pipe that comes down here. It starts out at 27-inch pipe, and then it goes to splits into two 18-inch pipes. And the farm that's just above this, where it gets green there.
Mm-hmm. Just ahead of us, but a ways off.
Yeah. Okay. That one is, well, it's a few hundred acres, and this is almost 400 acres of irrigated ground here. And both of those farms are irrigated almost without any electricity except for to run the pivot tires around.
Because you've got the hill there.
The pressure.
So,
coming down provides.
Right. So you have to pump it to the top of the hill?
No, that's all gravity flow out of the river that point, and then it goes in our pipe. And once you put it in a fixed enclosure, you generate pressure. So by the time you get to the end of our farm, which is by that log cabin down there, there's almost 70 pounds of pressure. These pivots are a lot more efficient as far as water use. So we went to put all
Vaughn
pivots
explained
on.
Explained the difference between the pivot and the wheel.
A whole lot less labor.
I gather, yes.
I have to jump out here, Kate, because I have to check the moisture of this field to see whether I just...
I'd like to see what you do.
All right.
I am amazed at how many little potatoes, at least at the end of that field. Well, there's some more. I mean, you could eat your whole winter off the ones that are left.
That's why we look for gleaners, but nobody ever wants to come anymore.
Really?
You'd think in this economy, more people would come.
How do you look for them? How do you, advertise, come pick up potatoes?
No, it used to just be part of the culture of this valley.
And would people then pay to come out?
No. Anything, and if we have gleaners out there,
we just give them away?
We just let them pick them up. We don't charge anything.
Oh, my God. Well, I'll come glean. I mean, my gosh. So how are you checking the moisture here?
Just by feel.
And what are you feeling for? I want to feel it, too. And you tell me. So the top is dry.
This top is real dry. So what I have to determine is...
And this is still attached. This is still trying to grow here, even though it's been supposedly killed off.
Right.
Tiny green.
It's hard to get all the vines and see what happens. Is some of these are probably really vigorous plants. So the more vigorous plants are ones that will keep a stem.
Now, can I pull that out? See if there's anything attached to it?
Most of the potatoes will come off of it.
Uh-huh, but a few did not. A couple of really nice big ones and a couple of very pretty little ones. Now, these furrows are what, about 8 inches deep?
Yeah, probably at least 10.
Okay. And the potatoes are planted how far apart?
This is about a 10 or 11-inch spacing.
Within one row, but the rows...
37-inch rows.
37, not 36.
No, we just choose to be odd. Most people do 36s, but...
Why 37? What difference does 1 inch make?
Just for tractor tire issues, it gives you a little bit more room.
Missed one.
Thanks.
Yeah. So how deep does the harvester dig?
Right to the bottom where that tire track is. That's about where your bottom potatoes are going to be.
Really? Mm-hmm. No deeper?
Nope.
Why not? Surface. Now, how do you kill the potato? You're not killing... Well, you are killing the plants. How do you do that here in the conventional fields? Yeah.
We use... A chemical is called a desiccant.
What's it called?
A desiccant.
Yeah, so that's the type of chemical.
It doesn't move in the plant's xylem or phloem at all. It's only active whatever it touches on the plant.
So when you say it doesn't move in the xylem or phloem, what are the xylem and phloem?
The circulation.
Okay. Getting back into the turn at this point, having checked the moisture in the field. Where are we headed next?
We're going to actually head back.
And are you going to get to eat your lunch?
I'm going to eat lunch either while we're parking or once I get back in the machine.
If the desiccant, if the herbicide moved into the xylem or the phloem, it would move through those into the potato.
Right. For example, Roundup moves systemically in the plant. So
right.
It will get in the xylem and phloem of the plant.
Which is why it can kill plants with hardy root systems.
Right.
Although
but
not
also,
as hardy as bindweed.
If you get that in, if you would spray, you know, people have thought, well, we can kill our potato plants with Roundup.
Oh,
no. Because it's cheap, but it gets into tubers.
Right, and then you're eating
for
it.
For seed, even if you're not going to eat it, if you use it for seed, it will stop germination or significantly.
Because it keeps working.
Right. Degrade germination for the next season.
Right.
For those tubers, so.
Right. So you use something, so you call it a desiccant, not an herbicide.
Yeah, it is an herbicide of sorts, but
it's one
that does not move systemically. It has no systemic action at all.
Right. What is it? What chemical do you use?
It's a... Diquat is the chemical name.
D-I-Q-U-A-T. Q-U-A-T. Diquat.
It's a chemistry name and the popular name that... consumer name is Reglone. And what we've done is through a number of different things. Even there, you know, we're always looking at ways that we can minimize impact. as far as chemistry and different things that we're doing. So what we've done is we've found that...
I mean, you're trying to move towards a more sustainable... culture that's less dependent on synthetic chemicals at any stage of the process.
Right.
Great.
So what we've done there is, you know, we put in a water softener so that chemistry isn't tied up in the water. We alter the pH of the water with various things to
make the reglone. You mean the chemical?
The chemical can be tied up in the hard water or high calcium or high pH water.
So then you would have to use more.
We'd have to use more. So what we used to do is we used to use two pints of this product up front and then another 2 pints later on.
Mm-hmm.
For a total of 4. Now, this field that we were just in...
2 pints per what? Acre?
Per acre.
Okay.
And this field that we were just in, I did with 1.5 pints. And we changed how we apply it and various things like that. And so we've less than half what we used to use.
Uh-huh.
And we also, by changing our fertilizer program, it's typical to want to grow a whole lot of vine, particularly on this variety, the Russet Burbank variety.
Uh-huh.
They'll grow great big vines, and the labs will tell us that we need, you know, fairly high nitrate levels in those. And we've reduced that nitrate level significantly, not trying to manage for vine, but trying to manage for insect and disease pressure. But by
because the insects and diseases will attack bigger vines, or
higher nitrate sap. Plants up that have higher levels of nitrate.
That's
a better food
source. So you've lowered your nitrogen in order to control for the diseases and pests that are attracted to the sap of the plant.
Right.
It's got a lot of nitrogen. And
right.
The result is...
But then you also get smaller vines, which are easier to kill and allow better airflow, so you have less fungal disease issues and all. I mean, it's a better deal all the way around.
You control better for fungal diseases,
yeah,
right? Because you have smaller vines.
You don't have to control as much because the air flows through better, so you don't get that real humid, damp, moldy conditions underneath in a canopy that's just too dense to move air.
Okay.
So really a lot of it is just a physical...
Did your yield drop off, though, when you had smaller vines?
No. We're not trying... We don't sell potato vines. We sell the tubers.
Yeah.
And... That's one of the things that, you know, we commonly think, well, the better the vine looks, the better the field looks. Well, in actual reality, we measure... So at the end of the year, starting in mid-August, we'll start measuring... once a week or even more often than that sometimes in 10-foot sections. We'll take 10-foot of one of those rows, dig it up, weigh every tuber in that row so we know exactly what size they are and what the projected yield would be based on that 10-foot dig. If we do that weekly for a couple weeks, we can project how much that field is gaining per day.
Right.
And we'll find that the more vigorous the vines, the less they gain per day. And if a field is senescing or starting to show age and that sort, you don't want them dead, of course. They have to still be alive and relatively healthy. But if they're slowing down, the vines are starting to yellow out, the nitrate levels are getting very low, they'll put a lot more weight per day on. Thank you.
Two things here. First, the idea that tubers actually put on more weight as the vines decay. Now, I've heard that you don't want a potato plant that has full lush greenery because that means that the plant is putting all of its energy into the foliage instead of into the tubers. But the idea that the tubers actually gain weight faster as the vines are dying is so counterintuitive. I don't know. Who'd have thunk it? But secondly, the amount of energy that goes into determining harvest time just floors me. That they would be digging up 10-foot sections of a row, weighing every single potato in it, sometimes more than once a week, in order to calculate how much the field as a whole is gaining. I just had no idea.
Do
want the vines to be dead eventually. I mean,
most home
growers don't actively kill their vines and just wait for them to die.
Sure. And frost is, in this area, usually pretty helpful for making that happen.
Yeah, indeed.
Sometimes too helpful.
Comes before the potatoes are as big as you want them to
be. That's right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what kinds of potatoes are you growing here?
Conventionally.
Yeah.
We grow all russet-type potatoes.
Jason told me a little bit about what was involved in breeding potatoes and gradually improving the line. And once again, this was both more complicated and way more interesting than I would have predicted. every spring, he and his family plant a plot with some of their very best potatoes. And in the autumn, they sort through the harvest from those mother plants, as they're called. The smaller ones are cut up and used as their seed potatoes. A piece of a potato with just one or two eyes can produce an entire plant. But the very best from that harvest are saved and are planted as whole potatoes to produce more mother plants.
We have about 20-acre plot. That's all we do is grow and select. And a lot of that is hand-cut, hand-planted, and hand-dug.
Right.
In that area.
So they really get babied.
Yep. It's a different plot every year.
Okay. Jason talked about how the Kims use crop rotation, another key aspect of sustainability. Since the soil doesn't have to keep supporting the same crop year after year, it doesn't get depleted, which means there's less need for fertilizers. Also, any diseases that might have gotten established in the crop during one year usually die out before that crop is planted again, because they can't survive on the different crops that are grown there on intervening years. So there's less need for fungicides. Again, pests that might feed on the potatoes probably don't feed on the other crops that are planted in other years, and that means that their numbers are reduced. So there's less need for pesticides. Jason's family makes green manures, as they're called, part of their rotation. These are crops which are actually plowed under rather than harvested. And that plant organic matter enriches the soil, once again, reducing the need for synthetic fertilizers.
Yep.
I see. Okay. So the green manure, which actually gets dug in,
right,
is the last thing you do before you plant potatoes, so that the field is particularly rich.
Right, and we're just starting to work with that. We've been doing a compost with a local dairyman for a number of years, and so we're still working with that as well, but just looking at different ways that we can improve soil health.
Well, that was one something else. This is something I'm going to want to come back sometime and ask you about at length, because I'm going to want to do a show on compost tea. But you just explain a little bit about what this is? I know that in the old days it meant putting either some compost or some composted manure in a burlap bag and sticking it in a barrel and swishing it from time to time.
Right.
And then you spray the liquid on your plants.
Right.
And I gather you are making compost tea from manure, not from vegetable compost.
We make a manure-based compost that we spread across the land of this farm, but I don't use that for my compost tea.
Okay.
I'm using basically plant-based, 100% plant-based green manure, where there's a fellow who grows crops specifically to make a really high-end compost, and he composts that in vessel so that there's very little chance of contamination with any other pathogens.
Right.
That way, in a brewing situation, it just reduces my potential for...
Are you making the compost tea?
Yeah, I make compost tea as well as we make compost for the farm. And the compost that I buy for my tea,
it's made from a green manure.
Yeah, it's all a green-based corn, peas, alfalfa, beans.
Okay, so a vegetable compost.
Yeah.
What most people mean when they say compost.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Good. And that is, I gather, something that you are using on your conventional fields. So let's review here for a moment. Jason uses a manure compost on his fields. He uses compost tea on his fields. And he uses a green manure on his fields. These are his conventional fields.
From this foliar disease. And the reason that we even pursued doing any of this is about a year or two before that. Well, in the sort of decade preceding that, their late blight Phytophthora infestans had got pretty close to this area.
And that's a pretty devastating disease.
That's a devastating potato disease.
Isn't that the
Irish potato blight?
Yeah, the one that killed millions.
Right. And it is a devastating and very difficult to control disease. And so what we did as a group of area farmers, we said, hey, we need to start, you know, thinking communally. So we're going to spray, you know, everybody's going to commit to spraying X number of times with fungicides to make sure that doesn't come in this area or whatever. Well, what we started seeing on our farm is that we started seeing in-season viral insect-vectored diseases that
insect-vectored meaning carried by insects.
Carried by the insects, right, that we had never seen here before.
Whoa, when was this?
That was in about probably 1996, 7, 8.
So this is while you're doing the extra spraying to protect from late blight, and so you got more insect-borne diseases.
Right, and that's when I was at college, and I happened to be picking up a research journal on potatoes that had an article. I think it was done by the University of Maine or mm-hmm. somewhere out on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And basically they said, hey, our fungicides are killing a native population of fungus that exists on a potato leaf that is a predatory towards aphids. And I said, hey, this is
that
not
protects the plant from
protects
aphids.
The plants from aphids.
But that's
at least
good.
It kept the populations from you know, it's not going to be 100%, but it kept the populations from exploding. And said, hey, you know, this is a bad situation. We can't just be spraying fungicides just because, even in, you know, weather that's not conducive and those sort of things, which we had been doing
for
the last few years.
You just sprayed them on a schedule.
On a schedule.
Right.
And so then we started saying, okay, how can we do this differently? And then while we were asking those questions, we were introduced to the compost tea idea and said, hey, we can re-inoculate some of the beneficial organisms that will allow us to protect both from foliar diseases like late blight, although I would certainly never go on record as saying that compost tea is a 100% control to late blight.
It helps.
Is not. It is a tool, and the healthier the plant is, the more resistant we can keep it. And so we look at compost tea as is keeping the plant healthy.
Late blight is a fungal disease.
Late blight is a fungal
disease.
And
that's why you were using fungicides to control it. Okay.
So there's some debate in there.
Yeah.
You know, and at the end of the day, I don't know exactly. I'm still feeling it out for myself to find out where I'm going to come down.
Uh-huh. Me too.
I've certainly seen that there are responses from compost tea.
Uh-huh. So you now use it on all your conventional fields as well.
Right.
Do you still use the fungicides? In other words, do you spray the fungicides and then spray compost tea to reestablish the beneficial?
So far, we haven't used the fungicide for more than 10 years now.
Really?
Yep. And we do use a seed piece fungicide, which is actually, interestingly enough,
derivative. You spray the seed potatoes?
The pieces, after we cut them up, actually that's where we'll put some of, on the conventional side, we'll use a longer-term insecticide as well as fungicide on those seed pieces. That allows us not to have to spray with an airplane or run things through pivots or wheel lines, so that it's more friendly to neighbors and people who are around the fields.
So you're not spraying even your conventional fields with herbicides or pesticides?
We've reduced that probably by, I'd say, 50 to 60%.
Since the 90s?
Since 2000, about when we started using these more biological programs.
Right? Okay.
So we've reduced it a fair bit. I wouldn't say that we're 100% free of them.
Uh-huh.
The one thing that I have to say is that, you know, the things that we do use, we used to use very broad-spectrum insecticides. They would, you know, if an animal was in the field, they would kill an animal. That's the technology that we had. Nowadays, you know, they're very, very specific as far as we tend to use ones that just control aphids, and that's their only targeted pest.
Right.
And so we can even keep established levels of ladybugs and things like that in the field, which is pretty cool to see.
Because the ladybugs prey on aphids.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so we look at, you know, insect management, not just from having to apply. Even sometimes in the organic realm, we think about, well, we need to apply something to kill a population of aphids that's in the field. And we try not to think that way. Even in conventional mindset, we think, okay, how can we build this plant system so that that plant is healthy enough that the insects don't see it as a food source for them? Because what we do know is that insects will see a sick plant as a food source and not a healthy plant. And so that's our primary defense against every disease and insect pathogen, is saying, not how can we use compost tea and the microbes that are in it, or not how can we use different control mechanisms, whether they be chemical or organic, but how can we have this plant healthy enough to resist the various pathogens or predators that may be in the area.
So you would only use these aphid-killing insecticides, for instance, if you have a serious problem?
Yeah, the interesting thing with seed potatoes is that there's not really a threshold. So in disease management classes, we'll talk about a threshold of insects where you can get up to a certain number of aphids per acre before they start impacting yield to the point where it makes it worth paying for a spray. In seed potatoes, that's not the case, because any population of aphids will spread the diseases that are in the field. So if there is a disease in our field or our neighbor's field, and we allow, you know, aphids to have basically any foothold, they will spread those diseases.
So if you see an aphid,
yeah,
you're worried.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something you want to see any aphids in a seed potato field.
Okay.
And even in my organics, because I'm in a seed area, I manage that just the same way. I don't want to see any aphids in my organic field at all.
But you can't use the insecticide there.
I can't use insecticide. And, you know, with all the pan trapping and all the different things we do to manage plant health in the organics, I also have seen almost no aphid issues in the organic. Or, you know, and I have certified last year, this will be my second year in the certification with the university for seed as well as an organic certification on that plot. And we have not had a disease issue of any kind. Part of that is, you know, the community aspect of farming where, you know, all the neighbors around who are raising larger amounts of seed potatoes are doing a good job of controlling their diseases. And because of that, it makes it easier for me. Now, if I was in a commercial potato growing area where people didn't care about these diseases because mm-hmm. it's not an issue that's going to go for, you know, human consumption. And so if you have a couple of virus plants out there, nobody really cares. It would be much more difficult.
Right. But everybody cares.
But everybody here cares. And
they're cooperating.
Yeah. And that's one thing that, you know, as far as the local, the gardeners and people in the area too, the university this year is going to print for the first time a seed catalog of all locally grown Montana seed potatoes, whether they're conventional or some of our organics will also be listed in that directory, where people can get almost any variety that they want from Montana grown sources, which
nice.
Saves us a huge amount of headache as far as, you know, particularly a lot of the both organic and conventional seed that's brought in by gardening magazines does not meet anywhere close to the stringent standards that Montana has for our seed. And so when gardeners bring that kind of seed into this area, it puts farmers at a very increased risk level. And there's some thought that last year the late blight issues that happened in Kalispell could have been due to greenhouse tomatoes that were brought in by some of the bigger department stores and things like that. And,
yeah.
And if you think about the economic loss and the families that are put at risk by those kind of decisions, if we can, as a community, think how can we work together to protect each other, and one way that we can do that, that, you know, the local gardeners here can help work with us and we can work with them, is, you know, we'll provide a really clean, high quality source of as many different varieties as we can as a state and make them available to people. And we need their help to buy those varieties from a local source instead of using their
internet to bring them in
exactly,
from elsewhere.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I'd much rather get my seed potatoes locally, but I was thrilled to hear that Yvonne is growing some purple ones because I want those.
Right.
But I didn't know where to get them locally.
Right. And so we have, you know, we've a seed potato. I was talking to a gardener who's doing a little bit more than just small scale gardening up in the northern part of the state, and mm-hmm. he's been buying seed potatoes from all over the place, and he's just noticed a huge difference in his yields and what he's able to get by where he buys his seed from. And whenever he gets, you know, the cleaner seed that comes from within the state, he can do better.
Also, it's better adapted to the area.
Yeah, there are some truth to that as well.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, let me change the subject here. I want to ask you about something a little scarier, which is that I did some research when I was doing an organic lawn care article. I ended up looking at a lot of pesticides and pesticide information and learned that, in particular, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has gone up. I've forgotten the percentage now. It's enormous in the last quarter century, and it's largely farmers. And one of the key suspects is pesticide exposure. And you mentioned something about being friendlier to the neighbors when you're talking about spraying fields. It's also your health.
For sure.
And your kids.
Yeah, we used to, you know, with the irrigation, you have to be irrigating all the time. So when we used to spray, you know, there's restrictions. You're not supposed to be in a field for 12 hours or 24 hours. Well, sometimes, you know, if you have to get something fixed or whatever. And it used to not be, I mean, it wasn't even possible. You'd get sick. And so we have managed away from as much
you'd
of that.
You'd get sick? You mean you'd feel sick?
Yeah, you get headaches and stuff if you're around.
And you've had that experience?
Those were, you know, the pesticides that we used probably more than a decade ago. And
that's happened to you? Yeah.
So they're not friendly. There's some of those chemistries that are acutely toxic to humans as well. And,
right.
and we have eliminated all of those chemistries from anything that we use in our farm. And I think most of the neighbors have too. I'm up at the airplane site a lot, and I don't see those kind of chemistries being used. I think as a community, we've recognized, hey, there's better ways mm-hmm. to control some of these pests. And hopefully some more of this thinking holistically about as far as, you know, fertilization management and how that impacts plant health, so that we don't have to use as many pesticides and things like that mm-hmm. will catch on. Mm-hmm. There's so many things to think about when you think about pesticide use. For example, herbicides, you know, I mean, it takes me on my organic plot, I hire a crew of about 10 kids, and it takes them a couple days, and, you know, that bill on 2 acres is soon, you know, $500 or more dollars an acre for me to weed that to the point where I want it weeded. I want it clean. I don't want to have a weed mess out there at all. And if you think about that on a large scale...
And that has to be done by hand.
By hand.
Because you don't use herbicides.
There's no herbicides used there.
Right.
And we use some cultivation, mechanical cultivation as well. But on potatoes, you can only mechanically cultivate for so long. Otherwise, you start having other...
You're going to damage the tubers.
Damage to the tubers and the plants and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, you think about, well, how can I reduce herbicides? And we have managed as best we can with tillage and everything else to reduce herbicide use. And we've done a fairly good job, but... to reduce it to the point where there's none used is very, very difficult. And you say, okay, where's that trade-off where there's the labor and the people who want to do it available to provide the weeding versus, you know, a $10 application of a herbicide? And those are difficult questions to answer, and I'm not sure that we have really good answers yet on some of those questions.
Yeah, well, if you solve that problem, you'll be rich. you can give up potato farming. But how do you use an herbicide in a potato field? After all, you don't want to kill the potatoes.
There are selective herbicides as well that we can use that will provide us...
That won't damage potatoes.
That won't damage the potatoes at all. Yeah.
Okay.
So that some of them are grass control herbicides. Some of them are broadleaf control herbicides.
And potatoes are neither of those categories. And
they do fall into the broadleaf category, but we can... They're smart in that range of chemistry. I don't know how they do it, but uh-huh. they figured out different mechanisms where they can control different broadleaf weeds that we have troubles with out here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. I mean, some of the work that was done with Charles Walters and in some of his Acres publications, Weeds and Why They Grow or something to that effect, you know, we've known that there are certain soil conditions that will accentuate certain weeds. And it's pretty interesting that, you know, a lot of the weeds that we have are associated with very good soils. For example, red root pigweed is probably one of the primary weeds in this area, and it's always associated with very good quality soils, and there's not much you can do to manage away from it as far as fertilization.
You don't exactly want to rip your soil to get rid of the weed.
You don't want
to
sterilize things.
No.
So.
At this point, Jason actually had to start working again, so I climbed up beside him into a tractor. It was a very large, very clean machine, with an air-conditioned cab set high enough to give us a terrific view of the ground beneath us, especially as the windshield in front of us came down to our feet. Oh, this is great. I have a confession. Oh, yeah, I've just got everything in the wrong hand. I've never been in a tractor.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to confess that... This is the first day that I've run this particular machine. My brother's irrigating today, and he wanted me to run this for him. So.
Okay, so we're in the tractor. We're driving along quite slowly, 2-3 miles an hour, maybe?
Right now, 1.7.
Okay, 1.7. And Jason's looking backwards as we drive. I'm not sure how he stays pointed exactly where he's supposed to be. But behind us is a very large conveyor belt up which goes rumbly tumbling a big mix of 4 rows worth of potatoes, dirt, and dead potato vines. We don't think of potatoes or tomatoes for that matter as being a vine, but they are. And I was holding the microphone in the wrong place for all of that. That's life. Okay, so up they go. Now, I actually read an article about you. Sorry, I did a bit of research.
Uh-oh.
And it had a story about why you had turned to organic cultivation. Can you tell us that story?
About personal health?
About personal health. And I tell you what, I'll hold this over here
okay.
So you can look where you need to look. Okay?
Yeah, basically about the same time as we were talking about earlier, about that 10 years ago time frame.
When you were still in college?
Yeah. I was, my wife now and I were dancing and had a little bit of a
dancing accident. Thanks for the stress of that accident.
A dancing accident? Okay, yes. I won't ask.
Country swing dancing
accident. Oh, yes.
Anyway, thanks to the stress of that, I got pretty sick and a poor college diet and a lot of other factors, I'm sure, but I ended up with ulcerative colitis that I struggled
with. Ulcerative colitis?
Right.
Ouch.
I struggled with that for a number of years and did the traditional, conventional medical approach, everything the doctors asked me to do, and I just didn't get any better. I didn't get worse, but I never felt good. When you're not feeling well, you're not terribly excited about life. It's just, it's kind of a tough time. So, thanks to Providence, I think I ran into a doctor in Billings who did whole food nutrition and took me from being at least 3 years sick, having precancerous polyps removed from my colon, and some pretty bad times. And within a month, I was 100%. And
it was just, 1 month?
Huh? 1 month. 1 month. And he got me thinking about, you know, food as medicine as opposed to just as calories.
Right.
And when I started to see that, you know, the healing impact that food could have, within just a couple of weeks of taking this nutrition supplements, I had this tremendous, you know, resurgence of health. And Yvonne also then had struggles with dizziness and fainting.
Goodness.
From the accident, because she had head trauma. And she also started then going and seeing him and got rid of the dizzy spells and all that kind of thing. So that all was taken care of with whole food and drink. I didn't do anything else. I didn't change drastically my diet. I still drank way too much pop and all those sort of things.
Wait a minute. You just said you didn't change your diet. I thought you did change your diet.
I changed what I took as far as nutritional.
But you still ate ice cream if you wanted to.
A lot of ice cream and too much sugar and too much soda pop and all those sort of things. And even despite doing all those things wrong, meeting those same guidelines.
Well, that makes sense, but I've still got a question here. You said whole foods, and you said something about, I thought you were talking about eating, you still ate unhealthy things, but you were careful to eat lots of healthy ones. But then you said something about supplements that this doctor, so I'm a little confused.
The supplements that I took from him were all whole food nutrition. So if it was part of a beet, it wasn't synthesized or fractioned vitamin C or any part of a beet or any part of an animal. It was the whole tissue. If it was liver tissue, it was the whole liver tissue of the animal. If it was beet, you know, it was the beet in the whole fraction. Vitamin C, the same thing. It wasn't isolated ascorbic acid. It was vitamin C, the way that God created vitamin C in orange, or a potato actually has very high levels of vitamin C if it's grown properly.
Most people, I don't think, know that.
I don't think so either.
No, we think of lemons and oranges.
Yeah, potatoes actually have very, very high, relatively speaking, fairly high levels of vitamin C, as well as some amino acids that are difficult to get other places. And according to some researchers, a little bit of protein that's a very unique and very beneficial form of protein. So
now, most of us think of potatoes as a source of starch.
Right, and in general, they're primarily a source of starch, but one of the ways that, in fact, the guy who designed some of the nutrition protocol that I did, one of his favorite vegetables to juice was the potato, and it needs to be consumed really quickly after you juice it. It's not stable at all, but he said it was one of his favorite vegetable juices to use because of the vitamin C presentation and the protein presentation that we find in potatoes. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And on that same line, you know, as far as all the things that we do to grow a healthy potato, we also have to look at breeding and the impact of plant breeding on plant nutrition.
What do you mean?
So, for example, right now there's a researcher in Idaho, or a number of them actually, that are looking at some of the seed stocks from potatoes in South America and saying, okay, what are the amino acids or what are the phytonutrients that are contained in these potatoes versus what we're growing commercially today? So have we selected primarily for yield and disease resistance, or have we looked also at taste and nutrition?
Okay, hang on. So when you are looking at these potato strains from South America, you're talking about wild ones because that's where potatoes come from originally. The high deserts of South America, is that right?
Correct, yep.
Okay, so you're looking at old native potatoes.
The native potatoes, yep.
And you're trying to analyze their food and nutrient content and then compare those to the potatoes produced conventionally?
Right. They're doing that. You know, some of that research is going on with the universities in Washington, and there's a tri-state university program, which is Idaho. It's a breeding program combined of Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. They're looking at some of those things in the breeding of potatoes now.
That's fascinating.
Which is really good news for everyone and for us, too. And one of the things that they tell us is, you know, as far as some of those phytonutrients go, the Yukon Gold is a very good potato variety.
What?
One of the things we look at when we're farming as far as that insect control goes, and the reason that high nitrogen saps attract insects is because they like free amino acids in the plant
the insects
sap.
Insects do?
Not complex proteins. Their food source is a free amino acid. And there's some research done and compilated in France in probably the middle part of the 1900s that showed that the higher levels of free amino acids and reducing sugars or simple sugars that were found in a plant, the more the insects liked it.
Okay.
So what we've tried to do, one of the things we measure is Brix levels, and that's the sugar level of the plant sap. As that sugar level goes up, they tend to find, and this isn't my research, but they tend to find that there's higher levels of complex proteins and complex sugars that the insects don't like. So we measure Brix and try to get that Brix level as high as we can in our plants. One thing they're concerned about with potatoes is acrylamide being formed in the frying process. So when we heat any starch to high temperatures quickly, we form this acrylamide.
Yeah.
That is a byproduct of reducing sugars in the tubers. Now, I'm not a tuber scientist, and I don't know all the implications, or I'm sure someone could debate some of this, but one thing that when we raise potatoes this way, we're trying to do is reduce the reducing sugars and...
reducing sugar?
It's a simple sugar. So the simple sugars are reducing sugars. And so,
as opposed to molasses, which is a but it's got a number of simple sugars. What's a simple sugar?
Simple sugar.
As opposed to a complex sugar.
You're going to make me delineate or explain things that are outside of my realm of expertise.
Absolutely. I want you to look like a fool.
Don't publish too much
of
this.
That's my goal.
But...
By the way, speaking of making it look like a fool, you realize there's somebody ahead of us in this row?
Yeah, I see him.
Trying to mow him down?
He'll move.
Okay. All right, you hope. So, go on. You're trying to reduce the number of simple sugars increase the number of complex ones.
Some of those researchers are telling us is that as that Brix level goes up, you form in the plant more complex sugars and complex proteins, less of the free amino acids or reducing sugars. And so our hope is that, and I don't know that this has been proved, but our hope is that the level of reducing sugars is also less in the tubers so that we can reduce the acrylamide content of fried starches. Not advocating eating fried potatoes, but at the same time recognizing that...
People do fry them.
There's been some research.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you because we're now only, maybe 30 feet from this fellow in a red shirt. I think this is your uncle. Do you have a dispute with him? Okay, he's starting to walk away. And as far as I can tell, he has been throwing large rocks out of the way. How kind of him. Okay, phew. Yes, he's out of the way. I'm pleased. Let me ask you one last sort of set of questions, and this is about... What can a home grow potato grower, a home farmer, backyard farmer, learn from your farming expertise about growing a few potatoes in his or her garden, if anything?
Well, obviously there's a lot of things that are different about growing potatoes in a garden versus doing them large scale like we're doing them here. But some of the simple things, water management, cultural management as far as building, how to build a hill, how deep to plant tubers. Those are a lot of the questions that I get from gardeners. How often should I water? How do I make sure that I get the right amount of water, not too much, not too little on? All those sort of things are things that I think gardeners, sometimes we try to micromanage the really specific trace mineral things and things like that, and we forget about the big picture things like how do you culturally manage a garden, or how should the soil be tilled, or how should the water be taken care of? That.
When you talk about cultural management, what do you mean, and what do you advise for potatoes?
All those things as far as tillage in the fall, tillage in the spring, how to build that hill properly, how to manage moisture, how to take care of looking for disease before it becomes a problem. Those are all what I call cultural management things that
Okay, well,
as important as all the different biological and things that we do here.
Okay, well, let's start with tilling in the fall. Why would you till in the fall?
If we can get a nice tillage in the fall, and it doesn't have to be like a rototiller type of till where we make really fine soil, what we want to do is loosen the soil up to allow water to penetrate as deeply as possible, then put some water. Don't ever let your soil go into the winter dry. You want to have some moisture down. That way, as the frost penetrates, it explodes and expands and contracts and breaks the soil apart. That's the very best tillage that you can get.
So you're actually setting it up. You do some tilling to allow water to penetrate, and then nature does the rest.
Let the frost work, and it's the very best tillage that any farmer can ever hope for, is to have some frost.
That's fascinating. I've never heard that one.
In fact, a soil will oftentimes be more compact this time of the year. If you say we get a really heavy early snow that doesn't melt, we had this last year by the river. We had, you know, a foot of snow and it never went away, and that ground never froze. This time of the year, the ground was so tight that you couldn't dig it with this equipment. It just went over in huge chunks off the end of the machines because it was so tight. And
you
that frost not, actually loosens.
You couldn't drive a big tractor and loosen the soil.
Well, once the hills are made, we make the hills in the fall, and that way the frost does our tillage in that hill instead of having to rototill it, which is a lot more destructive to soil structure than frost.
Why?
Just the pulverizing action of a high-speed tiller like a rototiller is very destructive. And also you're doing it in the spring, usually.
Yes.
And it doesn't seem to recover as well. I don't know exactly why that is, but I know that frost... Sorry. Oh.
It's okay. He's concentrating. We're at the end of the row. Backing up a bit. Oh, okay. Picking up a few we lost. Oh my gosh, you've got a fence right in front of you here, so you do not have a lot of room to maneuver. No, not at all. Now, is that your fence? Oh, you've got a water line there, too. You do not want to go over that water line. Okay, well, we missed it by at least a few inches. Good, good.
So some of the other things that, you know, as far as, you know, making sure your tubers are planted not too deep. What happens if we plant tubers too deep and you get wet, cool conditions in the spring?
They just rot.
They rot, but also if they do grow, what can happen is you get, you know, I gotta get myself out of the road here.
Sure.
You can get things like rhizoctonia, which is a root disease, fungal root disease. And those diseases like that wet, cool, slow-growing spring. And if you get them, if you plant a tuber too deep in the ground, it takes it so long to get up. It takes so much of the energy. You tend to get a lot higher levels of those root diseases in the spring if you don't have a nice warm soil. Sometimes we also think we got to plant really early in the real cold soils, and we're oftentimes better off waiting until the soils hit 50 degrees. And what we'll find is that time is not as important in growing a potato crop as
the right conditions.
The right conditions and having the right soil temperature. And they'll just pop right out of the ground if you wait till the soil warms up. You know, sometimes we have to break that rule just a little bit in commercial production because we have so many acres to plant and it takes us so long to do it that you have to sometimes break that a little bit. We try to wait till we hit at least pretty close to 50 degrees to do any planting.
Okay.
That's another thing. And then we oftentimes will, you know, we'll either irrigate way too much in a garden situation where it's just staying saturated too long, or otherwise we do way too much pulse irrigation where we irrigate a whole lot and then wait way too long. And potatoes need a more even moisture. They can't tolerate big fluctuations and being really wet. And really
what you want to do, Jason, now those people help themselves to some of these potatoes and they got Spitz laying in the rows. I don't know if those are contaminated. Hard telling.
your diviner, I think, is popped off and cogged out. It's laying almost on the ground.
What?
Your diviner has popped off the return rollers underneath. It's laying down on the ground on the one side.
I could see what he was talking about. A wide conveyor belt-like thing was trailing on the ground behind the harvester that his father was driving. This was the diviner. It was supposed to separate the vines from the potatoes and spit the vines back out onto the ground, while the potatoes moved on up a different conveyor belt and poured into the truck that rolled alongside the harvester.
I do have to go help him fix that.
Tell me how to get out of here.
Right there. Don't make me sound too bad. Be a little nice to me.
It was an easy promise to make. Yvonne was there to pick me up. She got to say exactly 4 words to her husband.
See ya.
I gotta help Dad. He's got a diviner problem over here, so see ya.
Bye, hon.
My meeting with Jason, which had been delayed by one mechanical problem, was now hurried to its close by another. It was 2:00. He had not yet had lunch.